whatever is necessary to disrupt UBL's plans. The American people are counting on you and me to take every appropriate step to protect them during this period. The State Department issued a worldwide threat advisory to its posts overseas. Then, on December 14th, an Algerian jihadist was caught bringing a load of explosives into the United States. Ressam's arrest. Ahmed Ressam, 23, had illegally immigrated to Canada in 1994. Using a falsified passport and a bogus story about persecution in Algeria, Ressam entered Montreal and claimed political asylum. For the next few years, he supported himself with petty crime. Recruited by an alumnus of Abu Zubaydah's Khaldan camp, Ressam trained in Afghanistan in 1998, learning, among other things, how to place cyanide near the air intake of a building to achieve maximum lethality at minimum personal risk. Having joined other Algerians in planning a possible attack on a U.S. airport or consulate, Ressam left Afghanistan in early 1999 carrying precursor chemicals for explosives disguised in toiletry bottles, a notebook containing bomb assembly instructions, and $12,000. Back in Canada, he went about procuring weapons, chemicals, and false papers. In early summer 1999, having learned that not all of his colleagues could get the travel documents to enter Canada, Ressam decided to carry out the plan alone. By the end of the summer, he had chosen three Los Angeles area airports as potential targets, ultimately fixing on Los Angeles International, LAX, as the largest and easiest to operate in surreptitiously. He bought or stole chemicals and equipment for his bombs, obtaining advice from three Algerian friends, all of whom were wanted by authorities in France for their roles in past terrorist attacks there. Ressam also acquired new Confederates. He promised to help a New York-based partner, Abdelghani Meskini, get training in Afghanistan if Meskini would help him maneuver in the United States. In December 1999, Ressam began his final preparations. He called an Afghanistan-based facilitator to inquire into whether bin Laden wanted to take credit for the attack, but he did not get a reply. He spent a week in Vancouver preparing the explosive components with a close friend. The chemicals were so caustic that the men kept their windows open, despite the freezing temperatures outside, and sucked on cough drops to soothe their irritated throats. While in Vancouver, Ressam also rented a Chrysler sedan for his travel into the United States and packed the explosives in the trunk's spare tire well. On December 14, 1999, Ressam drove his rental car onto the ferry from Victoria, Canada, to Port Angeles, Washington. Ressam planned to drive to Seattle and meet Meskini, with whom he would travel to Los Angeles and case LAX. They planned to detonate the bomb on or around January 1, 2000. At the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, pre-inspection station in Victoria, Ressam presented officials with his genuine, but fraudulently obtained, Canadian passport, from which he had torn the Afghanistan entry and exit stamps. The INS agent on duty ran the passport through a variety of databases, but since it was not in Ressam's name, he did not pick up the pending Canadian arrest warrants. After a cursory examination of Ressam's car, the INS agents allowed Ressam to board the ferry. Late in the afternoon of December 14th, Ressam arrived in Port Angeles. He waited for all the other cars to depart the ferry, assuming, incorrectly, that the last car off would draw less scrutiny. Customs officials assigned to the port, noticing Ressam's nervousness, referred him to secondary inspection. When asked for additional identification, Ressam handed the customs agent a Price Costco membership card in the same false name as his passport. As that agent began an initial pat-down, Ressam panicked and tried to run away. Inspectors examining Ressam's rental car found the explosives concealed in the spare tire well, but at first they assumed the white powder and viscous liquid were drug-related, until an inspector pried apart and identified one of the four timing devices concealed within black boxes. Ressam was placed under arrest. Investigators guessed his target was in Seattle. They did not learn about the Los Angeles airport planning until they re-examined evidence seized in Montreal in 2000. They obtained further details when Ressam began cooperating in May 2001. From the sidebar, a case study in terrorist travel. Following a familiar terrorist pattern, Ressam and his associates used fraudulent passports and immigration fraud to travel. In Ressam's case, this involved flying from France to Montreal using a photo-substituted French passport under a false name. Under questioning, Ressam admitted the passport was fraudulent and claimed political asylum. He was released pending a hearing, which he failed to attend. His political asylum claim was denied. He was arrested again, released again, and given another hearing date. Again, he did not show. He was arrested 4 times for thievery, usually from tourists, but was neither jailed nor deported. He also supported himself by selling stolen documents to a friend who was a document broker for Islamist terrorists. Ressam eventually obtained a genuine Canadian passport through a document vendor who stole a blank baptismal certificate from a Catholic church. With this document, he was able to obtain a Canadian passport under the name of Benny Antoine Norris. This enabled him to travel to Pakistan and, from there, to Afghanistan for his training, and then return to Canada. Impressed, Abu Zubaydah asked Ressam to get more genuine Canadian passports and to send them to him for other terrorists to use. Another conspirator, Abdel Ghani Meskini, used a stolen identity to travel to Seattle on December 11, 1999, at the request of Mokhtar Howry, another conspirator. Howry provided fraudulent passports and visas to assist Ressam and Meskini's planned getaway from the United States to Algeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. One of Meskini's associates, Abdel Hakim Taziga, also filed a claim for political asylum. He was released pending a hearing, which was adjourned and rescheduled 5 times. His claim was finally denied 2 years after his initial filing. His attorney appealed the decision, and Taziga was allowed to remain in the country pending the appeal. 9 months later, his attorney notified the court that he could not locate his client. A warrant of deportation was issued. Emergency cooperation. After the disruption of the plot in Amman, it had not escaped notice in Washington that Hijazi had lived in California and driven a cab in Boston, and that Deke was a naturalized U.S. citizen who, as Berger reminded President Clinton, had been in touch with extremists in the United States as well as abroad. Before Ressam's arrest, Berger saw no need to raise a public alarm at home, although the FBI put all field offices on alert. Now, following Ressam's arrest, the FBI asked for an unprecedented number of special wiretaps. Both Berger and Tenet told us that their impression was that more Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, wiretap requests were processed during the Millennium Alert than ever before. The next day, writing about Ressam's arrest and links to a cell in Montreal, Berger informed the president that the FBI would advise police in the United States to step up activities, but would still try to avoid undue public alarm by stressing that the government had no specific information about planned attacks. At a December 22nd meeting of the small group of principals, FBI Director Louis Free briefed officials from the NSC staff, CIA, and Justice on wiretaps and investigations inside the United States, including a Brooklyn entity tied to the Ressam arrest, a seemingly unreliable foreign report of possible attacks on 7 U.S. cities, 2 Algerians detained on the Canadian border, and searches in Montreal related to a jihadist cell. The Justice Department released a statement on the alert the same day. Clark's staff warned, quote, "Foreign terrorist sleeper cells are present in the U.S. and attacks in the U.S. are likely." Clark asked Berger to try to make sure that the domestic agencies remained alert. "Is there a threat to civilian aircraft?" he wrote. Clark also asked the principals in late December to discuss a Foreign Security Service report about a bin Laden plan to put bombs on transatlantic flights. The CSG met daily. Berger said that the principals met constantly. Later, when asked what made her decide to ask Ressam to step out of his vehicle, Diana Dean, a customs inspector who referred Ressam to secondary inspection, testified that it was her training and experience. It appears that the heightened sense of alert at the national level played no role in Ressam's detention. There was a mounting sense of public alarm. The earlier Jordanian arrests had been covered in the press, and Ressam's arrest was featured on network evening news broadcasts throughout the Christmas season. The FBI was more communicative during the Millennium Crisis than it had ever been. The senior FBI official for counterterrorism, Dale Watson, was a regular member of the CSG, and Clark had good relations both with him and with some of the FBI agents handling al-Qaeda-related investigations, including John O'Neill in New York. As a rule, however, neither Watson nor these agents brought much information to the group. The FBI simply did not produce the kind of intelligence reports that other agencies routinely wrote and disseminated. As law enforcement officers, bureau agents tended to write up only witness interviews. Written case analysis usually occurred only in memoranda to supervisors requesting authority to initiate or expand an investigation. but during the Millennium Alert, with its direct links into the United States from Hejazi, Deke, and Ressam, FBI officials were briefing in person about ongoing investigations, not relying on the dissemination of written reports. Berger told us that it was hard for FBI officials to hold back information in front of a cabinet-ranked group. After the alert, according to Berger and members of the NSC staff, the FBI returned to its normal practice of withholding written reports and saying little about investigations or witness interviews, taking the position that any information related to pending investigations might be presented to a grand jury and hence could not be disclosed under then-prevailing federal law. The terrorist plots that were broken up at the end of 1999 display the variety of operations that might be attributed, however indirectly, to Al-Qaeda. The Jordanian cell was a loose affiliate. We now know that it sought approval and training from Afghanistan, and at least one key member swore loyalty to bin Laden. But the cell's plans and preparations were autonomous. Ressam's ties to Al-Qaeda were even looser. Though he had been recruited, trained, and prepared in a network affiliated with the organization and its allies, Ressam's own plans were nonetheless essentially independent. Al-Qaeda, and bin Laden himself, did have at least one operation of their very own in mind for the Millennium period. In Chapter 5, we introduced an Al-Qaeda operative named Nashiri. Working with bin Laden, he was developing a plan to attack a ship near Yemen. On January 3rd, an attempt was made to attack a U.S. warship in Aden, the USS The Sullivans. The attempt failed when the small boat, overloaded with explosives, sank. The operatives salvaged their equipment without the attempt becoming known, and they put off their plans for another day. Al-Qaeda's planes operation was also coming along. In January 2000, the United States caught a glimpse of its preparations. A lost trail in Southeast Asia. In late 1999, the National Security Agency, NSA, analyzed communications associated with a suspected terrorist facility in the Middle East, indicating that several members of an operational cadre were planning to travel to Kuala Lumpur in early January 2000. Initially, only the first names of three were known, Nawaf, Salim, and Khalid. NSA analysts surmised correctly that Salim was Nawaf's younger brother. Seeing links not only with Al-Qaeda, but specifically with the 1998 embassy bombings, a CIA desk officer guessed that something more nefarious was afoot. In Chapter 5, we discussed the dispatch of two operatives to the United States for their part in the planes operation, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar. Two more, Khalid and Abu Barra, went to Southeast Asia to case flights for the part of the operation that was supposed to unfold there. All made their way to Southeast Asia from Afghanistan and Pakistan, except for Midar, who traveled from Yemen. Though Nawaf's trail was temporarily lost, the CIA soon identified Khalid as Khalid al-Midar. He was located leaving Yemen and tracked until he arrived in Kuala Lumpur on January 5, 2000. Other Arabs, unidentified at the time, were watched as they gathered with him in the Malaysian capital. On January 8th, the surveillance team reported that three of the Arabs had suddenly left Kuala Lumpur on a short flight to Bangkok. They identified one as Midar. They later learned that one of his companions was named Al-Hazmi, although it was not yet known that he was Nawaf. The only identifier available for the third person was part of a name, Salhasi. In Bangkok, CIA officers received the information too late to track the three men as they came in, and the travelers disappeared into the streets of Bangkok. The Counterterrorist Center, CTC, had briefed the CIA leadership on the gathering in Kuala Lumpur, and the information had been passed on to Berger and the NSC staff and to Director Free and others at the FBI, though the FBI noted that the CIA had the lead and would let the FBI know if a domestic angle arose. The head of the bin Laden unit kept providing updates, unaware at first even that the Arabs had left Kuala Lumpur, let alone that their trail had been lost in Bangkok. When this bad news arrived, the names were put on a Thai watch list so that Thai authorities could inform the United States if any of them departed from Thailand. Several weeks later, CIA officers in Kuala Lumpur prodded colleagues in Bangkok for additional information regarding the three travelers. In early March 2000, Bangkok reported that Nawaf al-Hazmi, now identified for the first time with his full name, had departed on January 15th on a United Airlines flight to Los Angeles. As for Khalid al-Midar, there was no report of his departure, even though he had accompanied Hazmi on the United flight to Los Angeles. No one outside of the counterterrorist center was told any of this. The CIA did not try to register Midar or Hazmi with the State Department's tip-off watch list, either in January when word arrived of Midar's visa, or in March when word came that Hazmi, too, had had a U.S. visa and a ticket to Los Angeles. None of this information about Midar's U.S. visa or Hazmi's travel to the United States went to the FBI, and nothing more was done to track any of the three until January 2001, when the investigation of another bombing, that of the USS Cole, reignited interest in Khalid. We will return to that story in Chapter 8. Section 6.2, Post-Crisis Reflection, Agenda for 2000. After the Millennium Alert, elements of the U.S. government reviewed their performance. The CIA's leadership was told that while a number of plots had been disrupted, the Millennium might be only the kickoff for a period of extended attacks. Clark wrote Berger on January 11, 2000, that the CIA, the FBI, Justice, and the NSC staff had come to two main conclusions. First, U.S. disruption efforts thus far had not put too much of a dent in bin Laden's network. If the United States wanted to roll back the threat, disruption would have to proceed at a markedly different tempo. Second, sleeper cells and a variety of terrorist groups had turned up at home. As one of Clark's staff noted, only a chance discovery by U.S. Customs had prevented a possible attack. Berger gave his approval for the NSC staff to commence an after-action review, anticipating new budget requests. He also asked DCI Tenet to review the CIA's counterterrorism strategy and come up with a plan for where we go from here. The NSC staff advised Berger that the United States had only been nibbling at the edges of bin Laden's network, and that more terror attacks were a question not of if, but rather of when and where. The Principals Committee met on March 10, 2000, to review possible new moves. The Principals ended up agreeing that the government should take three major steps. First, more money should go to the CIA to accelerate its efforts to seriously attrit Al-Qaeda. Second, there should be a crackdown on foreign terrorist organizations in the United States. Third, immigration law enforcement should be strengthened, and the INS should tighten controls on the Canadian border, including stepping up U.S.-Canada cooperation. The principals endorsed the proposed programs. Some, like expanding the number of joint terrorism task forces, moved forward, and others, like creating a centralized translation unit for domestic intelligence intercepts in Arabic and other languages, did not. Pressing Pakistan. While this process moved along, diplomacy continued its rounds. Direct pressure on the Taliban had proved unsuccessful. As one NSC staff note put it, "Under the Taliban, Afghanistan is not so much a state sponsor of terrorism as it is a state sponsored by terrorists." In early 2000, the United States began a high-level effort to persuade Pakistan to use its influence over the Taliban. In January 2000, Assistant Secretary of State Carl Inderfirth and the State Department's counterterrorism coordinator Michael Sheehan met with General Musharraf in Islamabad, dangling before him the possibility of a presidential visit in March as a reward for Pakistani cooperation. Such a visit was coveted by Musharraf, partly as a sign of his government's legitimacy. He told the two envoys that he would meet with Mullah Omar and press him on bin Laden. They left, however, reporting to Washington that Pakistan was unlikely, in fact, to do anything, given what it sees as the benefits of Taliban control of Afghanistan. President Clinton was scheduled to travel to India. The State Department felt that he should not visit India without also visiting Pakistan. The Secret Service and the CIA, however, warned in the strongest terms that visiting Pakistan would risk the president's life. Counterterrorism officials also argued that Pakistan had not done enough to merit a presidential visit. But President Clinton insisted on including Pakistan in the itinerary for his trip to South Asia. His one-day stopover on March 25, 2000, was the first time a U.S. president had been there since 1969. At his meeting with Musharraf and others, President Clinton concentrated on tensions between Pakistan and India and the dangers of nuclear proliferation, but also discussed bin Laden. President Clinton told us that when he pulled Musharraf aside for a brief one-on-one meeting, he pleaded with the general for help regarding bin Laden. I offered him the moon when I went to see him in terms of better relations with the United States if he'd help us get bin Laden and deal with another issue or two. The U.S. effort continued. Early in May, President Clinton urged Musharraf to carry through on his promise to visit Afghanistan and press Mullah Omar to expel bin Laden. At the end of the month, Undersecretary of State Thomas Pickering followed up with a trip to the region. In June, DCI Tenet traveled to Pakistan with the same general message. By September, the United States was becoming openly critical of Pakistan for supporting a Taliban military offensive aimed at completing the conquest of Afghanistan. In December, taking a step proposed by the State Department some months earlier, the United States led a campaign for new UN sanctions, which resulted in UN Security Council Resolution 1333, again calling for bin Laden's expulsion and forbidding any country to provide the Taliban with arms or military assistance. This, too, had little, if any, effect. The Taliban did not expel bin Laden. Pakistani arms continued to flow across the border. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright told us, "We did not have a strong hand to play with the Pakistanis. Because of the sanctions required by U.S. law, we had few carrots to offer." Congress had blocked most economic and military aid to Pakistan because of that country's nuclear arms program and Musharraf's coup. Sheehan was critical of Musharraf, telling us that the Pakistani leader blew a chance to remake Pakistan. Building new capabilities, the CIA. The after-action review had treated the CIA as the lead agency for any offensive against Al-Qaeda, and the principals at their March 10th meeting had endorsed strengthening the CIA's capability for that role. To the CTC, that meant proceeding with the plan, which it had put forward half a year earlier, hiring and training more case officers and building up the capabilities of foreign security services that provided intelligence via liaison. On occasion, as in Jordan in December 1999, these liaison services took direct action against Al-Qaeda cells. In the CTC and higher up, the CIA's managers believed that they desperately needed funds just to continue their current counterterrorism effort, for they reckoned that the Millennium Alert had already used up all of the center's funds for the current fiscal year. The bin Laden unit had spent 140% of its allocation. Tenet told us he met with Berger to discuss funding for counterterrorism just 2 days after the principals' meeting. While Clark strongly favored giving the CIA more money for counterterrorism, he differed sharply with the CIA managers about where it should come from. They insisted that the CIA had been shortchanged ever since the end of the Cold War. Their ability to perform any mission, counterterrorism included, they argued, depended on preserving what they had, restoring what they had lost since the beginning of the 1990s, and building from there, with across-the-board recruiting and training of new case officers and the reopening of closed stations. To finance the counterterrorism effort, Tenet had gone to congressional leaders after the 1998 embassy bombings and persuaded them to give the CIA special supplemental appropriation. Now, in the aftermath of the Millennium Alert, Tenet wanted a boost in overall funds for the CIA and another supplemental appropriation specifically for counterterrorism. To Clark, this seemed evidence that the CIA's leadership did not give sufficient priority to the battle against bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. He told us that James Pavitt, the head of the CIA's Directorate of Operations, said, "If there's going to be money spent on going after bin Laden, it should be given to him. My view was that he had had a lot of money to do it and a long time to do it, and I didn't want to put more good money after bad." The CIA had a very different attitude. Pavitt told us that while the CIA's bin Laden unit did extraordinary and commendable work, his chief of station in London was just as much a part of the Al-Qaeda struggle as an officer sitting in the bin Laden unit. The dispute had large managerial implications, for Clark had found allies in the Office of Management and Budget, OMB. They had supplied him with the figures he used to argue that CIA spending on counterterrorism from its baseline budget had shown almost no increase. Berger met twice with Tenet in April to try to resolve the dispute. The Deputies Committee met later in the month to review fiscal year 2000 and 2001 budget priorities and offsets for the CIA and other agencies. In the end, Tenet obtained a modest supplemental appropriation which funded counterterrorism without requiring much reprogramming of baseline funds, but the CIA still believed that it remained underfunded for counterterrorism. Terrorist financing. The second major point on which the principals had agreed on March 10th was the need to crack down on terrorist organizations and curtail their fundraising. The embassy bombings of 1998 had focused attention on al-Qaeda's finances. One result had been the creation of an NSC-led interagency committee on terrorist financing. On its recommendation, the president had designated bin Laden and al-Qaeda as subject to sanctions under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. This gave the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, the ability to search for and freeze any bin Laden or al-Qaeda assets that reached the U.S. financial system. But since OFAC had little information to go on, few funds were frozen. In July 1999, the president applied the same designation to the Taliban for harboring bin Laden. Here, OFAC had more success. It blocked more than $34 million in Taliban assets held in U.S. banks, another $215 million in gold, and $2 million in demand deposits, all belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and held by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, were also frozen. After October 1999, when the State Department formally designated al-Qaeda a foreign terrorist organization, it became the duty of U.S. banks to block its transactions and seize its funds. Neither this designation nor UN sanctions had much additional practical effect. The sanctions were easily circumvented, and there were no multilateral mechanisms to ensure that other countries' financial systems were not used as conduits for terrorist funding. Attacking the funds of an institution, even the Taliban, was easier than finding and seizing the funds of a clandestine worldwide organization like al-Qaeda. Although the CIA's bin Laden unit had originally been inspired by the idea of studying terrorist financial links, few personnel assigned to it had any experience in financial investigations. Any terrorist financing intelligence appeared to have been collected collaterally as a consequence of gathering other intelligence. This attitude may have stemmed in large part from the chief of this unit, who did not believe that simply following the money from point A to point B revealed much about the terrorists' plans and intentions. As a result, the CIA placed little emphasis on terrorist financing. Nevertheless, the CIA obtained a general understanding of how al-Qaeda raised money. It knew relatively early, for example, about the loose affiliation of financial institutions, businesses, and wealthy individuals who supported extremist Islamic activities. Much of the early reporting on al-Qaeda's financial situation and its structure came from Jamal Ahmed al-Fadl, whom we have mentioned earlier in the report. After the 1998 embassy bombings, the U.S. government tried to develop a clearer picture of bin Laden's finances. A U.S. interagency group traveled to Saudi Arabia twice in 1999 and 2000 to get information from the Saudis about their understanding of those finances. The group eventually concluded that the oft-repeated assertion that bin Laden was funding al-Qaeda from his personal fortune was, in fact, not true. The officials developed a new theory. Al-Qaeda was getting its money elsewhere, and the United States needed to focus on other sources of funding, such as charities, wealthy donors, and financial facilitators. Ultimately, although the intelligence community devoted more resources to the issue and produced somewhat more intelligence, it remained difficult to distinguish al-Qaeda's financial transactions among the vast sums moving in the international financial system. The CIA was not able to fund or disrupt al-Qaeda's money flows. The NSC staff thought that one possible solution to these weaknesses in the intelligence community was to create an all-source terrorist financing intelligence analysis center. Clark pushed for the funding of such a center at Treasury, but neither Treasury nor the CIA was willing to commit the resources. Within the United States, various FBI field offices gathered intelligence on organizations suspected of raising funds for al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups. By 9/11, FBI agents understood that there were extremist organizations operating within the United States supporting a global jihadist movement and with substantial connections to al-Qaeda. The FBI operated a web of informants, conducted electronic surveillance, and had opened significant investigations in a number of field offices, including New York, Chicago, Detroit, San Diego, and Minneapolis. On a national level, however, the FBI never used the information to gain a systematic or strategic understanding of the nature and extent of al-Qaeda fundraising. Treasury regulators, as well as U.S. financial institutions, were generally focused on finding and deterring or disrupting the vast flows of U.S. currency generated by drug trafficking and high-level international fraud. Large-scale scandals, such as the use of the Bank of New York by Russian money launderers to move millions of dollars out of Russia, captured the attention of the Department of the Treasury and of Congress. Before 9/11, Treasury did not consider terrorist financing important enough to mention in its national strategy for money laundering. Border security. The third point on which the principals had agreed on March 10th was the need for attention to America's porous borders and the weak enforcement of immigration laws. Drawing on ideas from government officials, Clark's working group developed a menu of proposals to bolster border security. Some reworked or reiterated previous presidential directives. They included creating an interagency center to target illegal entry and human traffickers, imposing tighter controls on student visas, taking legal action to prevent terrorists from coming into the United States and to remove those already here, detaining them while awaiting removal proceedings. Further increasing the number of immigration agents to FBI Joint Terrorism Task Forces to help investigate immigration charges against individuals suspected of terrorism. Activating a special court to enable the use of classified evidence in immigration-related national security cases. And both implementing new security measures for U.S. passports and working with the United Nations and foreign governments to raise global security standards for travel documents. Clark's working group compiled new proposals as well, such as undertaking a joint perimeter defense program with Canada to establish cooperative intelligence and law enforcement programs leading to joint operations based on shared visa and immigration data and joint border patrols, staffing land border crossings 24/7 and equipping them with video cameras, physical barriers, and means to detect weapons of mass destruction, WMD, and addressing the problem of migrants, possibly including terrorists, who destroy their travel documents so they cannot be returned to their countries of origin. These proposals were praiseworthy in principle. In practice, however, they required action by weak, chronically underfunded executive agencies and powerful congressional committees, which were more responsive to well-organized interest groups than to executive branch interagency committees. The changes sought by the principals in March 2000 were only beginning to occur before 9/11. Afghan eyes. In early March 2000, when President Clinton received an update on U.S. covert action efforts against bin Laden, he wrote in the memo's margin that the United States could surely do better. Military officers in the joint staff told us that they shared this sense of frustration. Clark used the president's comment to push the CSG to brainstorm new ideas, including aid to the Northern Alliance. Back in December 1999, Northern Alliance leader Ahmed Shah Massoud had offered to stage a rocket attack against bin Laden's Durunta training complex. Officers of the CIA had worried that giving him a green light might cross the line into violation of the assassination ban. Hence, Massoud was told not to take any such action without explicit U.S. authorization. In the spring of 2000, after the CIA had sent out officers to explore possible closer relationships with both the Uzbeks and the Northern Alliance, discussions took place in Washington between U.S. officials and delegates sent by Massoud. The Americans agreed that Massoud should get some modest technical help so he could work on U.S. priorities, collecting intelligence on and possibly acting against Al-Qaeda. But Massoud wanted the United States both to become his ally in trying to overthrow the Taliban and to recognize that they were fighting common enemies. Clark and Kofor Black, the head of the Counterterrorist Center, wanted to take this next step. Proposals to help the Northern Alliance had been debated in the U.S. government since 1999, and, as we mentioned in Chapter 4, the U.S. government as a whole had been wary of endorsing them, largely because of the Northern Alliance's checkered history, its limited base of popular support in Afghanistan, and Pakistan's objections. CIA officials also began pressing proposals to use their ties with the Northern Alliance to get American agents on the ground in Afghanistan for an extended period, setting up their own base for covert intelligence collection and activity in the Panjshir Valley, and lessening reliance on foreign proxies. "There's no substitute for face-to-face," one officer told us. But the CIA's institutional capacity for such direct action was weak, especially if it was not working jointly with the U.S. military. The idea was turned down as too risky. In the meantime, the CIA continued to work with its tribal assets in southern Afghanistan. In early August, the tribals reported an attempt to ambush bin Laden's convoy as he traveled on the road between Kabul and Kandahar City, their first such reported interdiction attempt in more than a year and a half. But it was not a success, According to the tribal's own account, when they approached one of the vehicles, they quickly determined that women and children were inside and called off the ambush. Conveying this information to the NSC staff, the CIA noted that they had no independent corroboration for this incident, but that the tribals had acted within the terms of the CIA's authorities in Afghanistan. In 2000, plans continued to be developed for potential military operations in Afghanistan. Navy vessels that could launch missiles into Afghanistan were still on call in the North Arabian Sea. In the summer, the military refined its list of strikes and special operations possibilities to a set of 13 options within the Operation Infinite Resolve plan. Yet planning efforts continued to be limited by the same operational and policy concerns encountered in 1998 and 1999. Although the intelligence community sometimes knew where bin Laden was, it had been unable to provide intelligence considered sufficiently reliable to launch a strike. Above all, the United States did not have American eyes on the target. As one military officer put it, "We had our hand on the door, but we couldn't open the door and walk in." At some point during this period, President Clinton expressed his frustration with the lack of military options to take out bin Laden and the al-Qaeda leadership, remarking to General Hugh Shelton, "You know, it would scare the shit out of al-Qaeda if suddenly a bunch of black ninjas rappelled out of helicopters into the middle of their camp." Although Shelton told the commission he did not remember the statement, President Clinton recalled this remark as, "One of the many things I said." The president added, however, that he realized nothing would be accomplished if he lashed out in anger. Secretary of Defense William Cohen thought that the president might have been making a hypothetical statement. Regardless, he said, the question remained how to get the ninjas into and out of the theater of operations. As discussed in Chapter 4, plans of this kind were never carried out before 9/11. In late 1999 or early 2000, the Joint Chiefs Director of Operations, Vice Admiral Scott Fry, directed his Chief Information Operations Officer, Brigadier General Scott Gratian, to develop innovative ways to get better intelligence on bin Laden's whereabouts. Gratian and his team worked on a number of different ideas aimed at getting reliable American eyes on bin Laden in a way that would reduce the lag time between sighting and striking. One option was to use a small, unmanned U.S. Air Force drone called the Predator, which could survey the territory below and send back video footage. Another option, eventually dismissed as impractical, was to place a powerful long-range telescope on a mountain within range of one of bin Laden's training camps. Both proposals were discussed with General Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then briefed to Clark's office at the White House as the CSG was searching for new ideas. In the spring of 2000, Clark brought in the CIA's Assistant Director for Collection, Charles Allen, to work together with Fry on a joint CIA-Pentagon effort that Clark dubbed Afghan Eyes. After much argument between the CIA and the Defense Department about who should pay for the program, the White House eventually imposed a cost-sharing agreement. The CIA agreed to pay for Predator operations as a 60-day proof-of-concept trial run. The small group backed Afghan Eyes at the end of June 2000. By mid-July, testing was completed and the equipment was ready, but legal issues were still being ironed out. By August 11th, the principals had agreed to deploy the Predator. The NSC staff considered how to use the information the drones would be relaying from Afghanistan. Clark's deputy, Roger Cressy, wrote to Berger that emergency CSG and principals committee meetings might be needed to act on video coming in from the Predator if it proved able to lock in bin Laden's location. In the memo's margin, Berger wrote that before considering action, "I will want more than verified location. We will need at least data on pattern of movements to provide some assurance he will remain in place." President Clinton was kept up to date. On September 7th, the Predator flew for the first time over Afghanistan. When Clark saw video taken during the trial flight, he described the imagery to Berger as truly astonishing, and he argued immediately for more flights seeking to find bin Laden and target him for cruise missile or air attack. Even if bin Laden were not found, Clark said, Predator missions might identify additional worthwhile targets, such as other al-Qaeda leaders or stocks of chemical or biological weapons. Clark was not alone in his enthusiasm. He had backing from Kofor Black and Charles Allen at the CIA. 10 out of 15 trial missions of the Predator over Afghanistan were rated successful. On the first flight, a Predator saw a security detail around a tall man in a white robe at bin Laden's Tarnak Farms compound outside Kandahar. After a second sighting of the man in white at the compound on September 28th, intelligence community analysts determined that he probably was bin Laden. During at least one trial mission, the Taliban spotted the Predator and scrambled MiG fighters to try, without success, to intercept it. Berger worried that a Predator might be shot down and warned Clark that a shootdown would be a bonanza for bin Laden and the Taliban. Still, Clark was optimistic about Predator, as well as progress with disruptions of al-Qaeda cells elsewhere. Berger was more cautious, praising the NSC staff's performance, but observing that this was no time for complacency. Unfortunately, he wrote, the light at the end of the tunnel is another tunnel. Section 6.3. The Attack on the USS Cole. Early in Chapter 5, we introduced, along with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, two other men who became operational coordinators for al-Qaeda, Khalid and Nashiri. As we explained, both were involved during 1998 and 1999 in preparing to attack a ship off the coast of Yemen with a boatload of explosives. They had originally targeted a commercial vessel, specifically an oil tanker, but bin Laden urged them to look for a U.S. warship instead. In January 2000, their team had attempted to attack a warship in the port of Aden, but the attempt failed when the suicide boat sank. More than 9 months later, on October 12, 2000, al-Qaeda operatives in a small boat laden with explosives attacked a U.S. Navy destroyer, the USS Cole. The blast ripped a hole in the side of the Cole, killing 17 members of the ship's crew and wounding at least 40. The plot, we now know, was a full-fledged al-Qaeda operation, supervised directly by bin Laden. He chose the target and location of the attack, selected the suicide operatives, and provided the money needed to purchase explosives and equipment. Nashiri was the field commander and managed the operation in Yemen. Khalid helped in Yemen until he was arrested in a case of mistaken identity and freed with bin Laden's help, as we mentioned earlier. Local al-Qaeda coordinators included Jamal al-Badawi and Fahd al-Kuso, who was supposed to film the attack from a nearby apartment. The two suicide operatives chosen were Hassan al-Khamri and Ibrahim al-Thawar, also known as Nibras. Nibras and Kuso delivered money to Khalid in Bangkok during Khalid's January 2000 trip to Kuala Lumpur and Bangkok. In September 2000, bin Laden reportedly told Nashiri that he wanted to replace Khamri and Nibras. Nashiri was angry and disagreed, telling others he would go to Afghanistan and explain to bin Laden that the new operatives were already trained and ready to conduct the attack. Prior to departing, Nashiri gave Nibras and Khamri instructions to execute the attack on the next U.S. warship that entered the port of Aden. While Nashiri was in Afghanistan, Nibras and Khamri saw their chance. They piloted the explosives-laden boat alongside the USS Cole, made friendly gestures to crew members, and detonated the bomb. Kuso did not arrive at the apartment in time to film the attack. Back in Afghanistan, bin Laden anticipated U.S. military retaliation. He ordered the evacuation of al-Qaeda's Kandahar airport compound and fled, first to the desert area near Kabul, then to Khoust and Jalalabad, and eventually back to Kandahar. In Kandahar, he rotated between 5 to 6 residences, spending one night at each residence. In addition, he sent his senior advisor, Mohammed Atef, to a different part of Kandahar, and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, to Kabul, so that all three could not be killed in one attack. There was no American strike. In February 2001, a source reported that an individual whom he identified as the Big Instructor, probably a reference to bin Laden, complained frequently that the United States had not yet attacked. According to the source, bin Laden wanted the United States to attack, and if it did, he would launch something bigger. The attack on the USS Cole galvanized al-Qaeda's recruitment efforts. Following the attack, bin Laden instructed the media committee, then headed by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, to produce a propaganda video that included a reenactment of the attack along with images of the al-Qaeda training camps and training methods. It also highlighted Muslim suffering in Palestine, Kashmir, Indonesia, and Chechnya. Al-Qaeda's image was very important to bin Laden, and the video was widely disseminated. Portions were aired on Al Jazeera, CNN, and other television outlets. It was also disseminated among many young men in Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and caused many extremists to travel to Afghanistan for training and jihad. Al-Qaeda members considered the video an effective tool in their struggle for preeminence among other Islamist and jihadist movements. Investigating the attack. Teams from the FBI, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, and the CIA were immediately sent to Yemen to investigate the attack. With difficulty, Barbara Bodine, the U.S. ambassador to Yemen, tried to persuade the Yemeni government to accept these visitors and allow them to carry arms, though the Yemenis balked at letting Americans openly carry long guns, rifles, shotguns, automatic weapons. Meanwhile, Bodine and the leader of the FBI team, John O'Neill, clashed repeatedly, to the point that after O'Neill had been rotated out of Yemen but wanted to return, Bodine refused the request. Despite the initial tension, the Yemeni and American investigations proceeded. Within a few weeks, the outline of the story began to emerge. On the day of the Cole attack, a list of suspects was assembled that included Al-Qaeda's affiliate, Egyptian Islamic Jihad. U.S. counterterrorism officials told us they immediately assumed that Al-Qaeda was responsible. But as Deputy DCI John McLaughlin explained to us, it was not enough for the attack to smell, look, and taste like an Al-Qaeda operation. To make a case, the CIA needed not just a guess, but a link to someone known to be an Al-Qaeda operative. Within the first weeks after the attack, the Yemenis found and arrested both Badawi and Kuso, but did not let the FBI team participate in the interrogations. The CIA described initial Yemeni support after the Cole as slow and inadequate. President Clinton, Secretary Albright, and DCI Tenet all intervened to help. Because the information was second-hand, the U.S. team could not make its own assessment of its reliability. On November 11th, the Yemenis provided the FBI with new information from the interrogations of Badawi and Kuso, including descriptions of individuals from whom the detainees had received operational direction. One of them was Khalad, who was described as having lost his leg. The detainees said that Khalad helped direct the Cole operation from Afghanistan or Pakistan. The Yemenis, correctly, judged that the man described as Khalad was Taufik bin Attash. An FBI special agent recognized the name Khalad and connected this news with information from an important Al-Qaeda source who had been meeting regularly with CIA and FBI officers. The source had called Khalad bin Laden's run boy and described him as having lost one leg in an explosives accident at a training camp a few years earlier. To confirm the identification, the FBI agent asked the Yemenis for their photo of Khalad. The Yemenis provided the photo on November 22nd, reaffirming their view that Khalad had been an intermediary between the plotters and bin Laden. In a meeting with U.S. officials a few weeks later, on December 16th, the source identified Khalad from the Yemeni photograph. U.S. intelligence sources had already connected Khalad to Al-Qaeda terrorist operations, including the 1998 embassy bombings. By this time, the Yemenis also had identified Nashiri, whose links to Al-Qaeda and the 1998 embassy bombings were even more well-known. In other words, the Yemenis provided strong evidence connecting the Cole attack to Al-Qaeda during the second half of November, identifying individual operatives whom the United States knew were part of Al-Qaeda. During December, the United States was able to corroborate this evidence, but the United States did not have evidence about bin Laden's personal involvement in the attacks until Nashiri and Khalad were captured in 2002 and 2003. Considering a response. The Cole attack prompted renewed consideration of what could be done about Al-Qaeda. According to Clark, Berger upbraided DCI Tenet so sharply after the Cole attack, repeatedly demanding to know why the United States had to put up with such attacks, that Tenet walked out of a meeting of the principals. The CIA got some additional covert action authorities, adding several other individuals to the coverage of the July 1999 Memorandum of Notification that allowed the United States to develop capture operations against Al-Qaeda leaders in a variety of places and circumstances. Tenet developed additional options, such as strengthening relationships with the Northern Alliance and the Uzbeks, and slowing recent Al-Qaeda-related activities in Lebanon. On the diplomatic track, Berger agreed on October 30, 2000, to let the State Department make another approach to Taliban Deputy Foreign Minister Abdul Jalil about expelling bin Laden. The National Security Advisor ordered that the U.S. message be stern and foreboding. This warning was similar to those issued in 1998 and 1999. Meanwhile, the administration was working with Russia on new UN sanctions against Mullah Omar's regime. President Clinton told us that before he could launch further attacks on Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or deliver an ultimatum to the Taliban threatening strikes if they did not immediately expel bin Laden, the CIA or the FBI had to be sure enough that they would be willing to stand up in public and say, "We believe that he, bin Laden, did this." He said he was very frustrated that he could not get a definitive enough answer to do something about the coal attack. Similarly, Berger recalled that to go to war, a president needs to be able to say that his senior intelligence and law enforcement officers have concluded who is responsible. He recalled that the intelligence agencies had strong suspicions, but had reached no conclusion by the time we left office that it was Al-Qaeda. Our only sources for what intelligence officials thought at the time are what they said in informal briefings. Soon after the coal attack, and for the remainder of the Clinton administration, analysts stopped distributing written reports about who was responsible. The topic was obviously sensitive, and both Ambassador Bodine in Yemen and CIA analysts in Washington presumed that the government did not want reports circulating around the agencies that might become public, impeding law enforcement actions or backing the president into a corner. Instead, the White House and other principals relied on informal updates as more evidence came in. Though Clark worried that the CIA might be equivocating in assigning responsibility to Al-Qaeda, he wrote Berger on November 7th that the analysts had described their case by saying that it has web feet, flies, and quacks. On November 10th, CIA analysts briefed the small group of principals on their preliminary findings that the attack was carried out by a cell of Yemeni residents with some ties to the transnational Mujahideen network. According to the briefing, these residents likely had some support from Al-Qaeda, but the information on outside sponsorship, support, and direction of the operation was inconclusive. The next day, Berger and Clark told President Clinton that while the investigation was continuing, it was becoming increasingly clear that Al-Qaeda had planned and directed the bombing. In mid-November, as the evidence of Al-Qaeda involvement mounted, Berger asked General Shelton to reevaluate military plans to act quickly against bin Laden. General Shelton tasked General Tommy Franks, the new commander of CENTCOM, to look again at the options. Shelton wanted to demonstrate that the military was imaginative and knowledgeable enough to move on an array of options, and to show the complexity of the operations. He briefed Berger on the infinite resolve strike options developed since 1998, which the Joint Staff and CENTCOM had refined during the summer into a list of 13 possibilities or combinations. CENTCOM added a new phased campaign concept for wider-ranging strikes, including attacks against the Taliban. For the first time, these strikes envisioned an air campaign against Afghanistan of indefinite duration. Military planners did not include contingency planning for an invasion of Afghanistan. The concept was briefed to Deputy National Security Advisor Donald Kerik on December 20th and to other officials. On November 25th, Berger and Clark wrote President Clinton that although the FBI and CIA investigations had not reached a formal conclusion, they believed the investigations would soon conclude that the attack had been carried out by a large cell whose senior members belonged to Al-Qaeda. Most of those involved had trained in bin Laden-operated camps in Afghanistan, Berger concluded. So far, bin Laden had not been tied personally to the attack, and nobody had heard him directly order it, but two intelligence reports suggested that he was involved. When discussing possible responses, though, Berger referred to the premise, Al-Qaeda responsibility, as an unproven assumption. In the same November 25th memo, Berger informed President Clinton about a closely held idea, a last-chance ultimatum for the Taliban. Clark was developing the idea with specific demands: immediate extradition of bin Laden and his lieutenants to a legitimate government for trial, observable closure of all terrorist facilities in Afghanistan, and expulsion of all terrorists from Afghanistan within 90 days. Noncompliance would mean U.S. force directed at the Taliban itself, and U.S. efforts to ensure that the Taliban would never defeat the Northern Alliance. No such ultimatum was issued. Nearly a month later, on December 21st, the CIA made another presentation to the small group of principals on the investigative team's findings. The CIA's briefing slides said that their preliminary judgment was that bin Laden's Al-Qaeda group supported the attack on the coal, based on strong circumstantial evidence tying key perpetrators of the attack to Al-Qaeda. The CIA listed the key suspects, including Nashiri. In addition, the CIA detailed the timeline of the operation, from the mid-1999 preparations to the failed attack on the USS The Sullivans on January 3, 2000, through a meeting held by the operatives the day before the attack. The slide said that so far the CIA had no definitive answer on the crucial question of outside direction of the attack, how and by whom. The CIA noted that the Yemenis claimed that Khalid helped direct the operation from Afghanistan or Pakistan, possibly as bin Laden's intermediary, but that it had not seen the Yemeni evidence. However, the CIA knew from both human sources and signals intelligence that Khalid was tied to Al-Qaeda. The prepared briefing concluded that while some reporting about Al-Qaeda's role might have merit, those reports offered few specifics. Intelligence gave some ambiguous indicators of Al-Qaeda direction of the attack. This, President Clinton and Berger told us, was not the conclusion they needed in order to go to war or deliver an ultimatum to the Taliban threatening war. The election and change of power was not the issue, President Clinton added. There was enough time. If the agencies had given him a definitive answer, he said, he would have sought a UN Security Council ultimatum and given the Taliban 1, 2, or 3 days before taking further action against both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But he did not think it would be responsible for a president to launch an invasion of another country just based on a preliminary judgment. Other advisers have echoed this concern. Some of Secretary Albright's advisers warned her at the time to be sure the evidence conclusively linked bin Laden to the coal before considering any response, especially a military one, because such action might inflame the Islamic world and increase support for the Taliban. Defense Secretary Cohen told us it would not have been prudent to risk killing civilians based only on an assumption that Al-Qaeda was responsible. General Shelton added that there was an outstanding question as to who was responsible and what the targets were. Clark recalled that while the Pentagon and the State Department had reservations about retaliation, the issue never came to a head because the FBI and the CIA never reached a firm conclusion. He thought they were holding back. He said he did not know why, but his impression was that Tenet and Reno possibly thought the White House didn't really want to know, since the principals' discussions by November suggested that there was not much White House interest in conducting further military operations against Afghanistan in the administration's last weeks. He thought that, instead, President Clinton, Berger, and Secretary Albright were concentrating on a last-minute push for a peace agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Some of Clark's fellow counterterrorism officials, such as the State Department's Shaheen and the FBI's Watson, shared his disappointment that no military response occurred at the time. Clark recently recalled that an angry Sheehan asked rhetorically of defense officials, "Does Al-Qaeda have to attack the Pentagon to get their attention?" On the question of evidence, Tenet told us he was surprised to hear that the White House was awaiting a conclusion from him on responsibility for the coal attack before taking action against Al-Qaeda. He did not recall Berger or anyone else telling him that they were waiting for the magic words from the CIA and the FBI. Nor did he remember having any discussions with Berger or the President about retaliation. Tenet told us he believed that it was up to him to present the case. Then it was up to the principals to decide if the case was good enough to justify using force. He believed he laid out what was knowable relatively early in the investigation, and that this evidence never really changed until after 9/11. A CIA official told us that the CIA's analysts chose the term preliminary judgment because of their notion of how an intelligence standard of proof differed from a legal standard. Because the attack was the subject of a criminal investigation, they told us, the term preliminary was used to avoid locking the government in with statements that might later be obtained by defense lawyers in a future court case. At the same time, Clark was aware of the problem of distinguishing between an intelligence case and a law enforcement case. Asking U.S. law enforcement officials to concur with an intelligence-based case before their investigation had been concluded could give rise to charges that the administration had acted before final culpability had been determined. There was no interagency consideration of just what military action might have looked like in practice, either the Pentagon's new phased campaign concept or a prolonged air campaign in Afghanistan. Defense officials, such as Undersecretary Walter Slocum and Vice Admiral Fry, told us the military response options were still limited. Bin Laden continued to be elusive. They felt, just as they had for the past 2 years, that hitting inexpensive and rudimentary training camps with costly missiles would not do much good and might even help Al-Qaeda if the strikes failed to kill bin Laden. In late 2000, the CIA and the NSC staff began thinking about the counterterrorism policy agenda they would present to the new administration. The Counterterrorist Center put down its best ideas for the future, assuming it was free of any prior policy or financial constraints. The paper was therefore informally referred to as the Blue Sky Memo. It was sent to Clark on December 29th. The memo proposed a major effort to support the Northern Alliance through intelligence sharing and increased funding so that it could stave off the Taliban army and tie down Al-Qaeda fighters. This effort was not intended to remove the Taliban from power, a goal that was judged impractical and too expensive for the CIA alone to attain. increased support to the Uzbeks to strengthen their ability to fight terrorism and assist the United States in doing so. Assistance to anti-Taliban groups and proxies who might be encouraged to passively resist the Taliban. The CIA memo noted that there was no single silver bullet available to deal with the growing problems in Afghanistan. A multifaceted strategy would be needed to produce change. No action was taken on these ideas in the few remaining weeks of the Clinton administration. Berger did not recall seeing or being briefed on the Blue Sky memo. Nor was the memo discussed during the transition with incoming top Bush administration officials. Tenet and his deputy told us they pressed these ideas as options after the new team took office. As the Clinton administration drew to a close, Clark and his staff developed a policy paper of their own, the first such comprehensive effort since the Delenda Plan of 1998. The resulting paper, entitled Strategy for Eliminating the Threat from the Jihadist Networks of Al-Qaeda, Status and Prospects, reviewed the threat and the record to date, incorporated the CIA's new ideas from the Blue Sky memo, and posed several near-term policy options. Clark and his staff proposed a goal to roll back Al-Qaeda over a period of 3 to 5 years. Over time, the policy should try to weaken and eliminate the network's infrastructure in order to reduce it to a rump group, like other formerly feared but now largely defunct terrorist organizations of the 1980s. Continued anti-Al-Qaeda operations at the current level will prevent some attacks, Clark's office wrote, but will not seriously attrit their ability to plan and conduct attacks. The paper backed covert aid to the Northern Alliance, covert aid to Uzbekistan, and renewed Predator flights in March 2001. A sentence called for military action to destroy Al-Qaeda command and control targets and infrastructure, and Taliban military and command assets. The paper also expressed concern about the presence of Al-Qaeda operatives in the United States. Section 6.4, Change and Continuity. On November 7, 2000, American voters went to the polls in what turned out to be one of the closest presidential contests in U.S. history, an election campaign during which there was a notable absence of serious discussion of the Al-Qaeda threat or terrorism. Election night became a 36-day legal fight. Until the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling on December 12th and Vice President Al Gore's concession, no one knew whether Gore or his Republican opponent, Texas Governor George W. Bush, would become president in 2001. The dispute over the election and the 36-day delay cut in half the normal transition period. Given that a presidential election in the United States brings wholesale change in personnel, this loss of time hampered the new administration in identifying, recruiting, clearing, and obtaining Senate confirmation of key appointees. From the old to the new. The principal figures on Bush's White House staff would be National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, who had been a member of the NSC staff in the administration of George H.W. Bush. Rice's deputy, Stephen Hadley, who had been an Assistant Secretary of Defense under the first Bush, and Chief of Staff Andrew Card, who had served that same administration as Deputy Chief of Staff, then Secretary of Transportation. For Secretary of State, Bush chose General Colin Powell, who had been National Security Advisor for President Ronald Reagan and then Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. For Secretary of Defense, he selected Donald Rumsfeld, a former member of Congress, White House Chief of Staff, and, under President Gerald Ford, already once Secretary of Defense. Bush decided fairly soon to keep Tenet as Director of Central Intelligence. Louis Free, who had statutory 10-year tenure, would remain Director of the FBI until his voluntary retirement in the summer of 2001. Bush and his principal advisors had all received briefings on terrorism, including bin Laden. In early September 2000, Acting Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, John McLaughlin, led a team to Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, and gave him a wide-ranging 4-hour review of sensitive information. Ben Bonk, Deputy Chief of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center, used one of the 4 hours to deal with terrorism. To highlight the danger of terrorists obtaining chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear weapons, Bonk brought along a mock-up suitcase to evoke the way the Aum Shinrikyo doomsday cult had spread deadly sarin nerve agent on the Tokyo subway in 1995. Bonk told Bush that Americans would die from terrorism during the next 4 years. During the long contest after Election Day, the CIA set up an office in Crawford to pass intelligence to Bush and some of his key advisors. Tenet, accompanied by his Deputy Director for Operations, James Pavitt, briefed President-elect Bush at Blair House during the transition. President Bush told us he asked Tenet whether the CIA could kill bin Laden, and Tenet replied that killing bin Laden would have an effect but would not end the threat. President Bush told us Tenet said to him that the CIA had all the authority it needed. In December, Bush met with Clinton for a 2-hour one-on-one discussion of national security and foreign policy challenges. Clinton recalled saying to Bush, "I think you will find that by far your biggest threat is bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda." Clinton told us that he also said, "One of the great regrets of my presidency is that I didn't get him, bin Laden, for you because I tried to." Bush told the commission that he felt sure President Clinton had mentioned terrorism, but did not remember much being said about Al-Qaeda. Bush recalled that Clinton had emphasized other issues such as North Korea and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. In early January, Clark briefed Rice on terrorism. He gave similar presentations, describing Al-Qaeda both as an adaptable global network of jihadist organizations